Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casello, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy we figured out how to record a podcast today.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
Also TBT.
Yeah, you guys haven't been in this this nightmarish tech hellscape that we've been a part of, but Dan and I for the last 2 weeks have been trying to figure out how to record podcasts again since I got a Mac, and now we're both on Macs, and apparently...
I've never been on a Mac. I'm on a Windows.
Oh, I thought you were on a Mac for some reason. Oh, nope. What we should have done is just given you the software I used to use.
You know what? I think we got it. We figured it out. I feel pretty good about this... 2 week process.
Yeah, I think let's just never speak of it again.
Yes, and ever. Hopefully we won't have to like reset all of our stuff like we used to do every week.
This is true. Okay, so a lot of stuff going on this week, Dan, so might as well jump into it. To start, Syracuse released a new depth chart, and usually these are just kind of boring, especially under Dino Babers, who I feel like has put almost as little stock into these things as Scott Schaefer did, and yet. This depth chart had a lot to it, and might as well jump in. We'll just go offense to defense. I'll just kind of highlight the changes, or at least the unique things that come up. Number one, Cameron Jordan, primary backup to Devin Butler. Found that interesting, considering we have so many players who could potentially fill that role. Also saw, more importantly, that KK Han, who's a walk-on, backing up Jamal Custis inside. Do you think that holds, or do you just think that's a random happenstance for right now?
I don't know what to think about that. With the other, I mean, honestly, like across the board, our receivers are so varied. It doesn't seem like we have a lot of like consistency with where we are placing these receivers on the depth chart in terms of like size. Like KK Han's a very tiny person. Or not? He's 167 pounds. While Jamal Custis is a converted like tight end size person at 6'5", and then like even down the list, like Sean Riley and Thompson Bishop are not very similar sized. Nikeem Johnson and Sherrod Johnson are not very similar sized. So it just seems like it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of like the way the depth chart's laid out for receivers doesn't seem to necessarily mean where they're positioned on the field itself, or it doesn't necessarily mean that like. They're going to be limited to like a spot or backing up a specific guy. I don't think that would make sense based on what we've seen. But I don't know nearly about enough about KK Han to like tell you if he's going to be a player or not. But it is interesting that he is in the two deep.
Yeah, it's interesting to see him in the two deep considering we have so many options. So either we have the best walk-ons in the country, or Dino hasn't seen enough out of some of these freshmen, the redshirts and true freshmen, to really slot them in there. I mean, keep in mind this is still a depth chart that's coming together. Well before we even get into camp, and Dino really starts to install, parts of this year's system. I mean, he's done a little bit of that. I know usually, 40% of the install, 50% of the install gets done between spring and kind of this early part of the summer, and then the rest happens kind of in the summer into fall camp. So, maybe he has more to see. I do like the size that Cameron Jordan brings. Russell Thompson Bishop, same deal. Like, they're just bigger guys, more physical. Like you said, like these guys really couldn't be more different. Custis being a much larger individual than KK Han. You can reverse that for the other inside spot between Riley and RTB. Nakeem Johnson, I think, really does, and I said this in the receiver preview article, does kind of present the maybe biggest potential in terms of jumping up and really becoming a playmaker right away for this team. So I'm looking forward to that. Also a tight end, not to be forgotten, Ravian Pierce, who I think is going to be this year's leading receiver. I could be wrong. Over on the offensive line, though, a couple things that I believe we were kind of convinced of have been shifted around a little bit. And again, this is also something that could change by kickoff. Aaron Servais, he moves back to center after spending most of the spring at offensive tackle. Coda Martin slots in at right tackle. I still think this ends up shifting. I still think that Heckel ends up that center, but it is interesting to see Heckel and Roberts get the ORD designation at left guard. I don't know if that's a product of Roberts still potentially like easing into things from his injury, or if for some reason Heckel really is giving him a battle and they really do like Servais' you know, progress at the center position after some hot and cold kind of starts last year.
Yeah, the Roberts tackle thing is the first thing that jumped out to me, because Roberts, you know, before the injury was, if not our number one, like our solid number two offensive lineman. I think he was probably our best lineman entering last year. And the fact that Heckel is, you know, in the running there and you know, kind of designated as the co-starter at this point, I would hope is a good sign. I hope it's more about Heckel's play than it is about Roberts' injury. But overall, like, I mean, we talked about a decent amount, but, like, it's very nice to see. I'm looking at seven offensive linemen in the five starting positions that I'm pretty comfortable with, at least in terms of their experience. Including Martin, and then both right guards and the top two at left guard. So who knows how it shakes out, and if Servais sits at center, I think there's a lot of different spots where we can move here. But and I'm not totally surprised to see Martin take over a starting job. I thought that was he was under every opportunity to do that after transferring in. But overall, like, I feel pretty good. We have seven guys with a lot of playing time.
Eight guys. You want to throw Byrne in there too? Well, I guess Byrne is one of the seven. Well, Byrne's one of the seven. Clark is probably the guy who's most ready to start.
Mike Clark is, yeah. All right, so that would be number eight.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel as we've always said, like, we need to see this offensive line do it, and we saw it a little bit last year. Obviously, the Clemson game was a highlight, and we saw it mostly in the first half last year before teams started, you know, just bum-rushing us with all the injuries. But right now, I feel about as good about this offensive line as I have since... probably the last team that went bowling, to be honest.
Yeah, 2013. I definitely agree there. I mean, you look at the size with these kids, too, and this is where I think the big change goes from, like, the back end of the Marone era until, like, what happened during the Schaefer era. You look at these guys, and some of these are Schaefer. Yeah, some of these guys are Schaefer recruits, admittedly, but look down this list, and you've got, what, four, five? You had five guys who were 6'6 or taller? That's insane.
Everyone's over 6'4", basically, except for Teton Darney. He's 6'3", so, like...
And he's a walk-on.
Yeah, and he's a big walk-on. Yeah. But everyone... I mean, it's very obvious here. Obviously, Adams is a little bigger. He's at 326. But looking at the top three, like, almost everyone here is in, like, the 6'4 to 6'6", and then, like, 290 to, like, 305 range. And that seems to be the sweet spot for where Babers likes to offensive lineman, which makes sense with... the pace at which the team plays. Like, you want leaner guys, and you want to be able to move up the field and get set and get snaps. The height thing is interesting to me. I don't know that there's a lot to it. I mean, but it's just a very tall offensive line. I don't know if that has any real impact, or if that just kind of happens to be how we are. But that is, it's kind of striking, because usually, you know, you have, especially in college level, you have a couple guys that are like 6'2".
True. And yeah, I mean, you would know better than I would in terms of linemen. I would think that having a little bit lower center of gravity is at least a bit better, because then somebody can't get up under you as easily on a block.
Yeah, it definitely helps. Usually you want to see, like, not want to, but usually you'll see the taller tackles and the shorter guards. Right. Adams being at guard is interesting, but also in the college game, like, you want to get your five best guys there, and you're not going to worry as much about, like, those specifics, because there can be a pretty large range in terms of ability. So you want to get your five best on the field. As long as your center in that case can snap.
Fair enough. And that is kind of, I mean, without knocking Servais too much, that's kind of going to be the one challenge for him, I guess. You saw, not that he was a bad snapper overall, but that the exhaustion did start to set in from the pace of play, from the fact that he was not playing his natural position. You definitely saw some of that as the year went on.
I think just the raw time he's been there now will hopefully alleviate a lot of that. I mean, the snapping is just like, that's very much a skill, and just like repetitive, just taking all those reps at center now, I hopefully means a lot. Like, just even in the off season, I assume he and Dungy have been working like nonstop basically since Dungy's come back from his injury. So hopefully it's much less of an issue this year. And if it is, like, we have the flexibility to make a change there.
Right. And I guess not to bury the lead, but really the defense is going to be the story of this. I know we talked a little bit about the offense, more because I feel like it's been the highlight of the Babers era, at least till now. Defensive line looks as it has on the step chart for the most part. But then you go into the back seven, and that's where things change a bit. To little fanfare, at least in the media guide that was released today, Syracuse is switching to a 4-2-5 base nickel scheme, which, to be honest... I feel like you and I did talk about a little bit last year as something that could potentially fix this.
It makes sense for the roster we're running out there right now, I think.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. I'm honestly just more surprised than anything that the two linebackers that are going to be in this scheme are Whitner and Guthrie, and not Guthrie and Armstrong.
It's a little surprising based on the size. Like we're going to be very small in the back seven here.
Yeah, I mean, for those who aren't looking at the media guide like we are, you got Whitner playing weak side.
Converted safety,
which is exactly why I thought that if we did play nickel, this would be the perfect way to do it. But yeah, Whitner's going to play weak side. Guthrie's going to play middle linebacker. You're going to have Cordy, who I thought it was a good move, and the more I saw Julian Wiggum's analysis, it seemed like an even better move. Nickel's going to allow him to really operate the way he did within the Babers system, except closer to the line of scrimmage. So I feel like, to be honest, like if you're going to use Cordy anywhere, this is really it. And we might actually see him probably used as best as he has been since 2015.
Yeah, I expect with him in that spot, I expect he's just going to be kind of a roving playmaker.
Yeah.
We have to see it. But usually when you see like a designation like this, like he'll be lined up in the nickel, but also you could see him drop back deep if we're playing a big offense that's in it over the top. We could see him come up the line of scrimmage. I bet we'll see him blitz a decent amount with his explosion. I'm not ready to like say that we're going to use him like Michigan did Jabril Peppers, but that's like the most obvious example of like a team going 4-2-5 a lot and then just sticking a playmaking safety, just having him go all over the field and just do different things and give different looks. I like the flexibility it gives us. I like the unpredictability it gives us, which is not a, you know, considering we still have some weaknesses in this defense, I think having kind of a, being able to create some havoc, which was something we have not done under these, with the Babers, quote, the Babers defense, but the Babers era defenses, versus like what Schaefer was able to do even in the bad years. Hopefully this helps us make more plays, which is something we really need.
Yeah, make more plays, and in particular, force more turnovers. What this defense has lacked in the last couple of years is really an ability to flip the field. I feel like at one point, Dungy was the only player to force a turnover in like a 5-6 game stretch.
Yep.
Which is just bad.
Of an interception, which is not ideal.
No, but props to him for wrestling that one out of a... I forgot who it was on Miami, but... I know he pulled that one off. I just feel like, in general, being able to flip the field, and that's where Cordy comes in, does make this offense a lot more palatable to run, because if you're able to flip the field like that, if you're able to score quickly, for teams that don't play at your tempo, it forces them to play at your speed very quickly. If you're able to score quickly and gain a double-digit lead right off the bat, suddenly a team is you know, behind the eight ball for the rest of the time. You can really, you know, kind of put your foot on the gas for the first 2-3 quarters. And you know, Syracuse kind of started slow last year and then spent the back half of the second quarter and the third quarter really kind of pouring it on. That fourth quarter was kind of where everything started to fall apart again. So if you suddenly create, you know, some momentum building exercises like we haven't really seen under Babers, that's where everything can really change. And I hope it does here. Some of the other notes, because Cordy moves out of the safety spot, you end up with Andre Sisco, who has only been on campus for a few months, at the starting safety spot. Evan Foster will keep his spot at the other for now. He's backed up by Eric Coley, who's the son of Vincent Reynolds, as well as Cam Jonas, another true frosh. At the corner spot, Scoop Bradshaw and Chris Frederick come back. But you're seeing a bunch of freshmen come up here. You get a red shirt and Fitu Melifonwu. You get Sisco and Jonas, as mentioned. Trill Williams, another freshman. Carl Jones has seen some select time in the corner. I really do like what this group brings potential-wise, even if we don't really know what we're getting out of them beyond probably Bradshaw, Frederick, Cordy, and I guess Foster to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be like the best guys going to play no matter what. And honestly, like, the results have been so poor, I don't know that just, like, getting some of these freshmen experience right off the bat and making them compete for playing time, which I think can happen in a lot of these spots, especially with Sisco already penciled in, is the worst idea. Like, we're not going to get that much worse, I don't think. So let's see what the big recruits like we have, like Williams and Sisco, can do. I think they're two of the more exciting players we have coming in across the whole roster. And then hopefully the experience we have on the outside with Bradshaw, with Frederick, with Cordy when he's on the outside guarding, can kind of help out with that, the back end stuff, which is going to be it might be a little bit of an adventure, but I think the upside is definitely there.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, we don't necessarily wade into the season lightly. Going on the road at Western Michigan doesn't spell easy game, but I think it's still easier than some of the past FBS opponents we've had to start the season. And the last time we started against an FBS team was Penn State back in 2013. But still, like, I do think that the Western Michigan game could be a good proving ground for a lot of these kids right off the bat. We get Wagner next week, and then we get thrown into the fire against Florida State. I think that's actually, considering these questions around Florida State secondary, we'll get into the schedule obviously later in the offseason, but given the questions around Florida State secondary, I do think that that's not a bad time to get the Noles, especially at the Dome.
Yeah, because their quarterback situation is also like still working itself out. I don't know if they'll even, I mean, there's a good chance they won't even have DeAndre Francois based on some of his legal issues, and he might not win that job anyway. So Florida State's definitely going to be a work in progress, so I don't mind getting them when we get them either.
Agreed. And if you're looking, I guess, if SU is going to upset somebody this year, I think Florida State and Louisville kind of the 1 and 2 there. I think Florida State's a top 25 team. I don't think Louisville is this year. I know some people are kind of back and forth there. Vegas seems to think they can win 8 games. I don't buy that for a second. But yeah, maybe, I guess.
I think that's very reputation-based. I think Louisville's an 8-win team, and that's just what they're penciling in.
Right. Yeah, like Lamar Jackson is not a small, you know, thing to remove from your offense or defense, yeah, no, or really just your team in general. It's not the type of thing where you can just replace him. And I don't necessarily buy Juwan Pass to the extent that he can replicate even half of Jackson's production. So I think Louisville would be top of my list in terms of teams we can upset at the Dome, but in terms of top 25 teams, I think we might only end up facing 3 of them this year in Florida State, Clemson, and Notre Dame.
Is Florida State even in the preseason top 25? This is a good most of them. Not in it to begin the year.
Most of them. Who are they face to start the season off? Oh, Virginia Tech.
Yeah, they have that season opener against Vatek, and then they have Samford. So
yeah, if they lose to Vatek, they're out. But if they beat Vatek, they'll definitely be probably around the 15-20 range. Clemson will probably be in the top 5. In all likelihood, Notre Dame could be anywhere from 5 all the way down to probably 20, depending on
NC
what
State
happens.
NC State could be in the top 25 as well.
I don't buy that.
I mean, they could be.
They could be. I mean, theoretically, sure. But that defense needs to fix itself, and I don't necessarily know if that's all going to be sorted out at all this season. ACC football kickoff started today. Coastal went first this year. Atlantic goes on Thursday. I don't know if you guys are going to hear this before we get to Babers being on with Dungy and Slayton, but you know, whatever. Worst case, just see this as a rundown of probably what will happen for SU, and also a recount of what did happen on Wednesday. Larry Fedora was an idiot today on I'd say Schaefer ISIS levels of insanity, talking about the attack on football, the fact that CTE was not really proven, apparently. He did mention that kids shouldn't start playing until middle school, which I do agree with. But he also talked about that if football goes, America goes with it.
That's like a literal thing he said. That wasn't like a thing he inferred. Yeah. That's a thing he said multiple times.
Yeah, he, you know, as I mentioned in the article on the blog, you know, football is America, change is bad. Therefore, like, we somehow end up at the troops as well, where Larry Fedora claimed that our troops are the best in the world because we have more football than everybody else. I wish I was kidding about any of this.
No one ever tell Larry Fedora about the military-industrial complex. He doesn't think that's a thing. All of the military might in this country is because football exists. Going back to the days of George Washington, it's been because of football.
Rutgers is
the sole reason why America is the superpower it is today.
Which, that might explain recent times. Anyway.
Somewhere in Murfreesboro, Scott Schaefer definitely shed a tear while reading the comments today.
Somewhere in Murfreesboro, Scott Schaefer is listening to this podcast and like biting his way through like a leather belt. Okay, so yeah, you know, I mean, I know Fedora, especially with the beard, looks like he's from Jersey, but he's from Texas, College Station, proud military town. I don't have a solution for him here. I think college football and football in general can be saved just by way of being smart and caring about the players. As I mentioned in the post and I mentioned on Twitter, Fedora clearly doesn't care about the players and is in just clear denial about the dangers of playing football. You can coach football and care about the players, and you can coach the current game while also talking about how it can be fixed and adapted and adjusted. There's plenty of coaches that do that in both large and small ways. To see him just kind of be a CTE truther here is a strange turn of events that I wouldn't recommend for anyone on Thursday's session, though I'm sure if somebody wants to go Dabo into this conversation, I beg of you, please do it.
Ooh, Adazio could definitely do it.
Oh.
Adazio could easily one up him here if he really wants it.
I don't think Adazio wants it because I feel like somebody's already dragged him into the athletic department office,
They've already had the conversation whether or not they should like fake him being sick.
like Steve, just say dudes a bunch of times. That's all you have to do.
He
Just
just has one prolonged dude for 15
yeah, just
minutes
says
and doesn't take
dude.
any questions.
Mentions AJ
Everyone's
Dillon.
like,
That's
just way too long for Vine.
just
Like, I have no worries about Babers saying something that dumb.
no.
Definitely not Taggart. He's gonna be too busy selling. I'm trying to think of Doran.
He's
I think Doran has been bailed out by the fact that Fedora already did it. So like his fans be so mad about it that like he already got the message.
right.
Clawson, no, I don't see it. Dabo definitely could, but he has so much goodwill he could somehow spin it into people just not caring.
Well, Dabo, the thing with him is that you could roll this into like Fedora went into Dabo's wheelhouse of like he was like a step away because like you know Dabo's all about the war on
He
Christianity.
didn't bring up religion, like
No.
at least directly. He
Right.
brought up like the religion of football in America, but
So he was knocking on Dabo's door.
yeah, he and Dabo were definitely in the same neighborhood. He went in a slightly different direction. If he had said the word Jesus, we would have been like, Dabo would have been the one shedding the tear in Murfreesboro for some reason. Yeah, we were close. What am I missing?
I think that was everybody. Daz, Taggart, Dino, Clawson, Dorn, and yeah, that was
You got
everybody.
all of them?
Yeah, that was all of them.
Yeah, so it's definitely Dabo, but he's Dabo and he has that weird like charm, so he wouldn't matter any success, and he did go 3-9 last year. And then Adazio is definitely number one. Adazio could say something real dumb tomorrow. I don't know if he could hit Fedora levels though. That was all time. Like the fact that it the I didn't hear a damn thing from SEC Media Day today, but I heard a lot of things from ACC Media Day
Which
today
is a
is all you
first.
need to know. That is a bad sign if you're the ACC. Like, you want that, but you really don't want it because you know what that actually means.
Yeah, so we've got a couple minutes here till halftime. What I'm putting up an article in the morning that's going to kind of spell out the like big questions that Babers is going to see. Number one question, obviously being about Eric Dungy's health, and I think Eric also sees that question. The defense is going to be a hot topic. I think the next upset victim conversation that we just brought up was going to be a conversation, as well as I'm sure somebody might joke about some nepotism when it comes to his son-in-law, Coda Martin, grabbing that right tackle spot. Anything else that you see here? As like some big questions that Babers is probably going to be asked on the serious end. I'm also going to be adding some joke questions that we would ask if we were in attendance.
I think you pretty much hit on it. Dungy's the headliner always. His health is like 1B there. Now, luckily, he doesn't have to worry about. I mean, he'll have to answer, but he isn't coming off a head injury, thank God. And especially considering what happened today, Wednesday. But you know, he will have to answer the health stuff, which you get, and you're always going to get that. The defense is the one I'm looking forward to because this 4-2-5 announcement, like, really, just it didn't come out of nowhere, but like we didn't expect this to be like a completely on the depth chart change, I don't think. So I'm really looking forward to hear the rationale behind it, even though I think we kind of get it in terms of, like, looking at what's going on here. But I want to hear what Dino has to say about it, for sure. Who else is going besides Dungy? Like, is it Torty?
Slayton.
Okay. Yeah, I want to hear more about the defense. I think with the offense, like, we have, obviously there are questions with at receiver, but the defense is such a big deal this year, as, you know, it always is half the game. But there's so much riding on the defense taking that next step forward. And with these big system changes, I think that's really where my attention's going to be. And then beyond there, like, I think, you know, the questions about Martin are legitimate. I think when you make the moves that Baber's made this offseason, I think you invite those, and he should be asked those. So I have no problem with Tota Martin being, you know, penciled in here because he does have talent. He is from Texas A&M. Like, it's not like he came from nowhere. But when you make the hire that he did and you made that transfer that he did, like, you invite questions, and I think Baber's should hopefully answer them without being, like, too snippy. Like, I think Baber should just lay it out and say, you know, this is why I did this, and just understand that people are going to always have those questions when you make moves like that.
Of course. And I think, you know, it depends on how the questions are framed, too. If they're not accusatory, right, and they're more about, like, hey, like, is it weird, like, you know, coaching your son-in-law? Like, I feel like that's a way to go in with him that you're going to get, like, an entertaining answer, like a Dino answer.
And hiring your daughter's father-in-law.
Yeah.
Like, they're legitimate questions. And I think we get them from a football standpoint. Like, there are definite football reasons to do both those things. But I think you have to just lay it out there very plainly and say this was, you know, all about football. We happen to have this relationship. But, you know, it's not like we were just hiring some random dad and his son. Like, I just hope he answers those and takes it with, like, understanding that the questions are legitimate and doesn't, like, snap off. And not that Babers does that much, but, you know, we've had moments. I just hope he handles it well because – and even if he doesn't, like, it won't be the story of this AC Media Days. But
thank you, Larry. You know,
yeah, thank God. Like, I can't imagine what will have to happen tomorrow to upstage Fedora.
Right.
Probably not. Like, I just can't – there's nothing, really, unless someone goes, like, absolutely bonkers. But – yeah, overall, I just like to have a very clean experience here. And I think Babers is, like, almost always Nazis out of the park, relatively, at least. So,
well, everyone loves him. I think this is going to be – I think that he's still – as long as he keeps upsetting teams every year, there's always going to be a little bit of love for him.
I think this year is going to be the – this is, like, the honeymoon, like, breaking point year, though. I think he's had an extended honeymoon because of two upsets. I think rightfully so, there's, like, some – there's legitimate, like – he really needs to prove it this year. I don't know that it's bold, doom, or bust, but I understand why that might be the notion for a lot of people.
It's five wins, or people start getting a little nervous.
Yeah, I mean, if they go 4-8 again, like, I think the nerves are very legitimate because right. Then it's been, like, a real chunk of time. And coaches just aren't they don't sit around as long as they used to. Like, they don't get the same leash. It used to be that you got 4 or 5 years just by default because that was the amount of time it took to get all, you know, to basically flip the entire roster. That's just not the case anymore, right or wrong. So, yeah, I think he's in a fine place. I don't think Babers is anywhere near the hot seat right now, but I think this year you need to see, there needs to be, like, a very obvious step forward versus, like, you know, having to really pry for it.
I agree. And I think we'll have plenty more on that when we get to, like, the season preview episode, which is going to be its usual hour and a half extravaganza come August.
Always fun.
Always. It's actually that's usually our most listened to episode of the year. Even more so than the basketball one. Not because we don't know about basketball, just because people would know that football is the topic that you and I are going to be able to just riff on at a knowledgeable point for any amount of time.
Yeah, I don't blame them. I think, and there's also just less football. I mean, there's not, like, a total dearth of football content, but, like, Syracuse basketball, you can find some stuff.
Right.
Like, it's not hard to find the stuff you need there. Football,
where
it is more to cover, and also there are fewer places, like, covering it in depth.
Yeah.
Not that Syracuse.com doesn't do a fantastic
job. No, of course. Yeah, your choices for Syracuse football content are, for the most part, Brent, Nate, Steven, Chris, you and me. And then obviously some others here and there. But if you're looking for, like, originating content from places, those are kind of, like, where the original content's coming from.
and the occasional, like, David Hale talks to someone, or, like, the one Richard Johnson piece from last year.
Which was still good.
Which is great. Yeah, it was great. And we hope we get more of those.
Agreed, agreed. All right, why don't we hit some halftime and then talk about our least favorite conference, probably, the Big Ten. That's shade number one of many, I'm sure. Dan, what have you been drinking since we last spoke?
So I definitely had a decent amount of things. I think I was not too great about keeping my Untappd updated, but I was at a wedding in Vermont last weekend, or 2 weekends ago. I don't remember where we are here in history.
We haven't spoke since July 5th.
Okay. Yeah, so the weekend after that, I was at a wedding in Vermont. And so I had a decent amount of Vermont stuff. The wedding had mostly Long Trail, which is fine. I think Long Trail is a solid brewery. So I had their Long Trail Ale. I think I also had one of their IPAs. I'd say the most notable things I had, which one of them was very new for me, one of them was not, but is great. I had a Green by Treehouse Brewing, which is from Massachusetts, one of the better breweries in Mass.
Big fan.
Yeah, their IPAs are very, very, very good. Super juicy. Greens is rock solid. It's probably not even my favorite IPA from them, but I will drink it anytime I can get my hands on it. And then the highlight of the actual Vermont weekend was from Drop-In Brewing, which I believe is from up there. It's in Middlebury, Vermont. I had their Tart of Lothian, which was a super interesting Scottish Ale sour blend. And then it also had these like really nice, not overpowering coffee notes. But it was also super drinkable. None of that makes any sense, but trust me, it was all of those things. And it was definitely one of the more unique, really, really good beer experiences I've had recently.
Fair enough, fair enough. I like all those conversations. Okay, things I was drinking. One thing right out of the box that was very surprising to me, I was at a Greek restaurant and tried a... Macedonian Thrace Brewing Hellas. It's a Euro lager, and it was actually pretty good. Like a better Stella, but like toastier. Not like an everyday drink, but something that you could easily just like kind of drink a few of if you're out in the heat. Had a Smog City Farmhouse Rocks Saison, Pizza Port, and Stone comboed for a really good pale ale called BFF, Beer Friends Forever. Really fantastic beer. It's only hanging around, I think, like 5.9. I killed off the rest of my Lupinic Distortion Revolution number 10s. Also stopped down at Ballast Point in Long Beach, hadn't been there in a while, and had an Aloha Sculpin IPA with a lot of like kind of mango, guava, pineapple notes, and then had a Cheers to Old Grove IPA from them, which was just kind of like a nod to some of their old school IPAs that they used to make more of. Down in San Diego. So, not a ton of drinking on my end, but some here and there.
Yeah, I feel bad because I definitely have missed some recently on Untappd, which I'm usually on top of, but hopefully I'll remember those, or at least, you know, have more by next week.
I got some faith. Yeah, I might rely on you to carry the baton next week, because I'm going to be in Palm Springs this weekend. It's going to be like 112 degrees, so I'll be drinking... things on the lighter end, and probably a lot of them.
That certainly makes sense.
Indeed. Okay. So now we are moving on to the Big Ten. This is, like, not at all like the ACC, because we have a very large... Well, not large. But we have like a 4-5 team top, maybe a 4-team top. And then there's just, like, a very small middle class and then a lot of trash. So that's kind of what the ACC used to be. The Big Ten has now taken up that baton. I don't know, Dan, where do you want to start here? You want to start at the bottom and briefly mention the teams just so we do it? Or would you rather start at the top?
We can start at the bottom.
Sure. Okay. Teams that exist. Illinois, Rutgers, Minnesota, and Indiana.
You putting Maryland ahead of them?
Yeah, I'll put Maryland ahead of them. I think Maryland...
Nebraska is a work in progress,
yeah,
but Nebraska will be out of this range soon.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think Nebraska's above them still. I think Maryland has recruited really well, and I really don't love the fact that we have to face them next year.
Yeah. There's obviously, I don't know. I think they definitely have recruited quite well. I don't think it's totally translated yet, but I also think, like, they're always going to be very bogged down with that division. Same with Rutgers. Like, people are predicting, like, a pretty big step forward for Rutgers, but, like, it's going to be very hard for them to make really make it show on the record.
Because you start off the season with a minimum of 4 losses.
Yeah, unless you pull up a huge upset, but this year, like,
is not the year.
Rutgers might be decent. I don't know if they're going to beat any of those top 4 teams. It would be a very big upset if they did.
Yeah. So that's how this division goes. So if you want to, we can complain about Syracuse's place in the Atlantic, but it could be worse. We could switch places with Rutgers in the Big Ten East, and then know that we're starting 0-4 at minimum. And some years you get screwed and you have to face Wisconsin. So there's 5. And then there's the rest of your schedule, and you have to hope to God you win all of those games.
Yeah, at least in Rutgers' case, they pulled this. They made the schedule about as easy as they could. Otherwise, besides those the conference, they have Texas State at Kansas and Buffalo.
Yeah, and you know what? The Kansas stuff is the type of game that I wish we were seeing more of. Obviously, SU's done a better job of late of scheduling the non-conference. But Rutgers and some other schools have really done a smart job. I think BC got Kansas on the schedule too. Just wrapping up the Jayhawks, because they're just so far away from being competent that it's definitely smart to schedule that team as much as you can. Rutgers understands its place in the world. I'd say Rutgers is probably on par with Syracuse in terms of progress right now, but SU has a much better chance of seeing that progress in terms of a bowl game than Rutgers does just yet.
They're basically like mirror images of each other. I'm looking at Bill C's numbers. Bill C has a projected the split between offense and defensive ranking. He projects them to have the 29th best defense and the 119th best offense. That is not radically different from, I don't know what this year, I forget what the Syracuse projections are, because I know the article came out this week.
I think SU is probably between 40 and 50 on offense, if only because the team has not been overly efficient.
Yeah, that's the big, the numbers don't love SU's offense, I know that. But, like, if you told me that Syracuse had, like, the 29th best offense and the 119th best defense, I'd be disappointed by the defensive number in year 3, but I also wouldn't be, like, the most shocked. He actually has, it's actually interesting, he has a 56 and 82.
I buy that. I think, you know, you want the offense to be higher, and it probably will, because it doesn't take injuries into account.
Yes.
And so if it could, it would have us higher, I think. And again, it's all about efficiency too. Like, production is one thing, efficiency is another, and SU has not been overly efficient. We kind of talked about this divergence of Rutgers and Syracuse identity-wise, you know, when they made the hires they did. I know Chris Ash was kind of floated, whether or not that was real. Could have always been a trial balloon. Most SU fans were not necessarily thrilled with the idea of hiring Chris Ash, self-included. Because he was someone who had not been a head coach before. He was a defensive coordinator. We'd already gone down that road. So you're kind of seeing the results of that at Rutgers, though, where, you know, Rutgers wanted to hire, you know, a quality offensive coordinator to fix it. I don't really know John McNulty's bona fides, but I don't necessarily think they're that good at the moment. Dino might be faced with a similar question on the other side of the ball if this 4-2-5 experiment doesn't work out of, okay, like, you know, you're an offensive expert, now you need to hire a defensive expert to balance that out. This is the same thing. Ash is kind of falling into the same trap that Scott Schaefer did, not, you know, the knowing what you don't know situation and hiring accordingly. And the best offensive or defensive coaches are the ones that are able to hire really well on the other side of the ball that they're not necessarily experts at.
Yeah, and it's tough for Babers because he was a head coach and he did bring in basically the entire coaching staff. So he was bringing in a defense that worked for him elsewhere. I am at least glad, and obviously there are concerns with balancing recruiting and, like, results on the field with the staff that we have in place. I am glad to see us making a pretty radical change because clearly, like, the first 2 years just have not produced the results. So before we make, like, a big coaching change, at least we are, like, trying something new. And seeing if we can get the most out of the roster we have. Not to make this all about Syracuse.
Well, I mean, this is a Syracuse podcast, and considering how often we make it not about Syracuse when it is about Syracuse, this isn't the worst idea to at least relate it back to us a little bit. Yeah. All right. Like we said, Illinois exists. They're trash. Yeah, their other podcasts have done a better job of talking about just how bad they are. I don't think we need to talk about most of these teams. Moving up, I think we talked about Maryland a little bit. We'll have much more to say about them next year, to be honest, so I'd rather just waste that time on the Terps then. Nebraska. Scott Frost comes in. He could get this team back to competent in a hurry. They bring back a lot on defense. Yes. He did.
They went 0-12 to 6-6 in 1 year.
The caveat on the 0-12, if only because O'Leary basically quit on the team.
Yes.
And there was a lot of talent there. Yeah.
They weren't that far removed from being pretty good.
Yeah. So keep that in mind. Still, I do think I don't think Northwestern's heading for a Big Ten West title necessarily. But looking at the schedule, like, they could start 3-0, potentially. I mean, if they had faced Akron, Colorado, and Troy in the first 3 weeks last year, I would have potentially given them a 1-2 start.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they face Troy last year?
They did not. Last year they started with Arkansas State, Oregon, and Northern Illinois.
Arkansas State is who it was.
Yeah, and they barely beat Arkansas State. They lost to Oregon, and they lost to Northern Illinois, and that's when you knew that that old what's-his-face was getting fired.
Yeah, and even now, this isn't like Akron obviously has fallen back a bit since like their heyday. They're not terribleness under Terry Bowden. Colorado is a big question mark this year. We'll get to them in a couple weeks. Troy is always very good, and we've talked about Neil Brown a lot. Like, he's like, beating Nebraska, even in its diminished state, it could be huge for him personally in his never-ending quest to get a big head coaching job, despite the fact that he could have gotten one even the last 2 years, but the market's been weird. So, yeah, I think Troy is probably the scariest of these games. Like, Colorado, you're not going to have to talk your team into getting up for. I don't think they're a Pac-12 opponent. They're a historical rival. Akron, they should just walk over. I'm not too worried about Akron. Troy's going to be tough. Troy's going to really be out for blood.
Yeah, I can see.
That's a little bit of a look ahead spot to Michigan.
It is. Yeah, this schedule is going to be challenging. I'll give them the first three, and I'll give them Illinois and Minnesota. So that's five.
They'll have a puncher's chance. It's Purdue. Like, Purdue, I like, but it's Purdue at home. They'll really want that win, especially because they'll probably be coming off of a pretty ugly game at Michigan, unless Michigan's is not very good.
Yeah, I'd say that. If they win the games they're supposed to and they lose the games they're supposed to, the flex is going to be at Iowa and Purdue. And what they can do against those two teams. I could see them winning one of those and getting to 6-6 without, assuming they win the games again, win the games they're supposed to and lose the games that they're supposed to.
Yeah, you really want to get that Purdue win, because I would not want bowl eligibility up for grabs in a game at Iowa on the day after Thanksgiving.
No.
I don't know if we're going to transition into Iowa here.
Sure.
Kinnick Stadium is a terrible place. Terrible place for opposing teams. Now, Nebraska doesn't really fit the bill because they are not going to be a top five team unless something crazy happens on November 23rd. But road teams do not fare well there.
No. And Iowa in general, I mean, this defense brings back quite a bit. The offense brings back enough. I think, too, like Iowa... Where this Iowa, real brand of Iowa, differs from probably, you know, what we were used to with the Hawkeyes is that this recruiting has actually become like top 35 to 40 on a consistent basis. I was able to bring in a couple 4-stars every year. They're really doing a great job with the offensive line, with the running back position. Really, as long as you do those two well and then get enough three-star players on the defensive end, like, the Hawkeyes are good. And I think they can win, you know, 8, maybe 9 games some years. Sometimes you'll have those wacky ass, you know, 12-0 seasons like they did a couple years back. But Iowa seems pretty dangerous again, if only because of the division they're in. I would say if it wasn't for Wisconsin, if Iowa could jump up and beat Wisconsin, who knows? But I think Iowa's firmly entrenched in that two spot. Unless Northwestern like finds a way to get something together this year.
Yeah, I like Iowa more than Northwestern this season. The scheduling helps them. They have Wisconsin at home, which is a classic. It's probably not late enough in the season, but that is like the classic big time team, probably top 10 team, comes to Kinnick, I don't know if that'll be. I mean, I don't think the schedule is out that far yet. But if that's a night game, that's a real spooky spot for Wisconsin. Iowa State is actually going to be a really fun game. El Asico is going to be probably one of the more entertaining games of the first couple weeks. And then the road games are really manageable, except for Penn State. At Minnesota, at Indiana, Purdue's going to be tough. And then at Illinois, like, you should be able to get three of those for sure. At Penn State's the toughest game of the schedule. But then Northwestern at home, Nebraska at home, should be relatively easy when it's Maryland. And then you have Iowa State, Northern Iowa, Northern Illinois. Like, there are a lot of wins in the schedule. I don't think they're going to be good enough to pass Wisconsin, even if they pull up that upset. But
they could win 8 or 9 games this year without really batting an eye.
Yeah, and they've kind of, like, sneakily elevated themselves to where, like, a couple of years back, before that Rose Bowl run, like, there were a lot of, like, 5-6 win years in there. Now it's Iowa's kind of raised their game a little bit to where they're sitting at, like, 8 or 9 wins is a pretty attainable thing most seasons.
Yeah.
That's not a bad place to be.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's also a product of the division they're in. The Big Ten West obviously has its flaws, one of them being that, like, there is one traditional power in the division in Nebraska, but they've been pretty down lately. That's led to, in part, how Wisconsin has been able to turn into now a perennial top 10 contender. And I think this year is the year they break through for playoff bid.
I can see it. I still have questions about Hornibrook. There's something about, like, that brand of quarterback, and there are a lot of them in the Big Ten. I actually like Nate Stanley at Iowa, who's similar, but, like, Hornibrook and Lewerke in Michigan State specifically, like, their numbers are good, and I've watched enough of their games, I should know they're good, and I just can't quite get it. But then, like, I was looking at Wisconsin stuff on the way home today, and, like, the most shocking thing, and I read most of Bill C's Big Ten stuff, the most shocking single number is that Wisconsin was 7th in passing S&P last year.
How?
In the country. Not in the Big Ten.
How?
That's nuts. And the good point he made is that they get really manageable third downs, which it makes sense because their running game's unbelievable. So basically, they were just setting thirds and threes all the time. Hornibrook was really good at converting. Yeah, they're 7th passing S&P, and they're 1st in third down S&P. Like, they just move the chains. They're a machine. Their defense was really good. On defense, they kind of do the same exact thing that their offenses did at, which is staying out of bad situations and bad passing downs. On defense, they just put teams in bad situations and bad passing downs, and then they turn them over on downs or they force punts. They were just a real impressive machine last year, and they should be pretty similar this season.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, since we're going to do a quick Wisconsin thing here, Wisconsin's definitely a national title contender, which is weird to say. Hornibrook is not a great quarterback, but he's an efficient quarterback. He's your stock, Ohio State aside, Big Ten quarterback. This defense is always good. This offensive line is always good. Jonathan Taylor is a potential Heisman candidate. This team is going to be your stock Wisconsin team, but except with a lot more talent than they once had. And I've been impressed with what the Badgers, as much as I was impressed with what Iowa's done of late with their program and their stock, I think Wisconsin's done something even better and even more impressive. I think they're the class of that division until proven otherwise, and maybe you have to wait a year or two for the liftoff at Nebraska. But Wisconsin is going to be the odds-on favorite to win that division until further notice. And this year's schedule is super manageable for them. Toughest games at Michigan, at Penn State. So I think really the floor, and, like, barring an upset, you know, against Nebraska or at Iowa or at Northwestern, those aren't easy games. But I think the floor is still 10 wins for Wisconsin this year, which is impressive as hell. And if they can knock off Michigan, and I think they can, you're looking at an 11 or even a 12-win team potentially headed to Indianapolis.
Yeah, I mean, the tough games are at Iowa, at Michigan, at Penn State. And, like, they should win the West. The question is, once they get there, are they in position to make it to the playoff when they play in the championship game? And will they beat either, you know, there are 4 teams that could be there. But, you know, for sake of the debate, like, can they beat Ohio State? I think they can.
I don't think they will, but...
Yeah, they have to play their A game, which is tough. Ohio State has another level of talent. But there are questions there. And Wisconsin, I think we know exactly who they are. And they've just been so consistently good for so long now. And they just play within their system. And it doesn't really seem to matter who's playing there or who's coaching there. They just get, you know, they're exactly who they want to be every single year. Especially recently. Like, Paul Chris was like, I didn't really think anything of him at Pitt. And he is elevated them from where they were under Gary Anderson, which is obviously a weird situation. And honestly, like most of the Bielema tenure for sure. So like, it's just super impressive what they've maintained there, especially given like some of the limitations we've heard about in terms of academics and whatnot that have driven other coaches out. I do wonder, like, eventually when do they stop being like, when does the worm turn, and when do they get frustrated if they aren't able to break through the playoff? But there is a definite opportunity for it here.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, the next 2 years of Hornibrook and Jonathan Taylor do really create a unique window for them. Obviously, though, they're up against, you know, the buzzsaw that is an Urban Meyer Ohio State team. And we're going to get back to, I think, the Michigan State Northwestern group last, but I think it's worth talking about Ohio State. They are one of the probably three or four teams that are likely to win the national championship. They do seem like a playoff team. Nick Bosa is one of the best defenders in the country. Haskins is going to be the real question mark for them, while they have players like J.K. Dobbins just absolutely bulldozing everyone in front of them. But Haskins is going to be the real question. I think people like what they have seen in short glimpses from him. But this team is going to rise and fall on what the quarterback position can do. And it's never been a problem before. Urban Meyer's been able to plug in pretty much anybody just because of the quality of player he gets here. But I'm intrigued by what Ohio State's going to do. And I still love the fact that even though I don't love Ohio State, I love the fact that Ohio State's been able to play a completely different brand of football than everybody else in this division. And for some reason, nobody else is really copying it.
Yeah, they're kind of like a unique entity onto themselves. Like, obviously, they have spread principles, but they also do a really nice job of making the team, like, remaking the team on a year-to-year basis. Like, if Ezekiel Elliott's the guy there, they make the offense around him because he's such a, you know, triple threat. Versus, you know, if you have Cardell Jones in there versus JT Barrett versus Braxton Miller, like, Meyer's really good on the fly in terms of readjusting his offense. Now, there were some instances where Barrett didn't seem like he was being used the best possible way. And he had a couple just really, really awful moments, which led some people to like actually be excited about the Haskins move here. And he looked great when he filled in the Michigan game, led them from behind to beat Michigan last season. So he's not super tested, but he did go into a very high-pressure situation with very little experience and won a game against their arch rival. So that's, you know, not a bad sign. Haskins is the obvious question, but they return so much around him. You brought up J.K. Dobbins, who's a Heisman contender. Mike Weber is the other running back who would start for like 120 teams in the country. I think they bring back like two all-conference offensive linemen and then a third, two other guys with experience. And then defensively, like a ton of experience coming back. They lose, you know, a couple NFL guys, but I think they have like five or six guys with a lot of starting experience, plus, you know, you have Nick Bosa, who's one of the two or three best players, probably regardless of position in the country. And they added Alex Grinch to their coaching staff when they already have Bracciano. Like, how dumb is that?
Yeah, embarrassment of riches in any and all ways over there.
He was going to be the head coach of Washington State if Leach left.
I know.
And will probably be a head coach in the next 2 years, and he's coming to be, like, a backup defensive coordinator. Like, I think he's coaching, like, safeties, and he took a pay raise to go from being a Pac-12 defensive coordinator on the verge of being a head coach to, like, probably 1 or 2 years at Urban Meyer summer camp. It's ridiculous. They're just so talented. The question is if Haskins is ready, is up to it. And if he is, like, they are, they're going to be a national championship contender for the foreseeable future. This year is no different.
Yeah, and, I mean, they really get to... I'm not going to go any more into Ohio State than we need to here, but every game on the schedule is super winnable. There's really two big potholes on top of just the rivalry game with Michigan, and that depends on what you think of Wolverines. At Michigan State on November 10th seems like a trap, and at Penn State on September 29th, you win those two. If you tell me that Ohio State definitely wins those two games, they're going undefeated, at least in the regular season.
Yeah, at TCU is tough, but it's also not a true road game, and I'm not super. I like TCU a lot. I just don't think they have the. They're kind of like Michigan State for me, I think Michigan's a lot more talent, but like I think TCU and Michigan State are similar, where they're going to be really well coached and they're going to do the right things to win the game. It's just a matter of whether they can overcome the talent that Ohio State has.
No, completely.
So that one's not. I mean, if that one was in Fort was at Amon Carter, I think it'd be a lot more interesting. I think honestly that crowd will probably be like
50-50. Yeah.
TCU have the obvious location advantage, but Ohio State has way more fans.
Right.
And they'll travel.
Yeah, and I mean, TCU obviously can just drive down the road. It's not a question of whether they can do that. It's just because it's going to be such a larger stadium, Ohio State fans can fill that place. I mean, just look at any time Ohio State's been in the Cotton Bowl, their national championship abilities.
I mean, at Oklahoma, they had a ton of fans a couple years ago.
Yeah, they'll be fine. Wrapping us up here, I think I want to talk about kind of like the four-team, like, fun. I think that's the four most fun teams, even if I probably hate two of these athletic departments. Michigan State and Penn State. Michigan State brings back virtually everybody from a team that made a bowl game, looked pretty good doing it.
Bill C said on defense they have a level of continuity that almost no one can match. I think they bring back all but like two guys that had nine or more tackles, and those two guys were like good but not like superstar players.
Right. Yeah, I have full faith in Michigan State being able to not just replicate but surpass what they did last year. The only pitfall for them, just like the only pitfall for Penn State really, is just the division you're in. If Penn State or Michigan State were in most of the other divisions in college football, they'd be the favorites to win it.
Yeah, the East is just so tough. At some point, like, I think we talked about it with all of these conferences, but at some point, we just need to ditch divisions, and it would just be so much more interesting if we didn't have to worry about the alignments, because Big Ten can be so interesting, and four of the five best teams arguably are in one division. Like, and it's going to be that way for a while. I mean, it's not like a new thing. It's obviously there are shifts, and Nebraska we hope will rise up, and that's like the goal of this breakdown. But I mean, as long as you have Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State in one division, like, there's a very good chance on any given year those are the four best teams in the whole conference.
Right. But yeah, I guess a quick thing on Penn State, so we can move right along. A, do you think Trace McSorley is a Heisman contender? And B, do you think Miles Sanders can do any sort of impression of Saquon Barkley, or at least enough to make this offense continue running at the clip it was?
Yes, and I wouldn't say impression. I think Miles Sanders could be incredibly effective. I think odds are he's a very different player than Barkley, who was so boom or bust. Not bust, really. He was like boom, or there weren't a lot of like really nice 7-yard runs. Like, right. He was just exploding for 60, like four. I think the biggest question with Penn State, and it actually mirrors what Ohio State had a couple years ago, is if the loss of Joe Moorhead just kind of not derails their offense. I mean, it could in their case. Ohio State didn't derail their offense when they lost Tom Herman. But JT Barrett had his best year as a redshirt freshman under Tom Herman and was not the same afterwards. He was good. He was a Heisman contender the one year under Herman. Does losing Joe Moorhead to Mississippi State, I trust McSorley actually more than I trusted Barrett. He's in the NFL now. But I just don't know if the offense will continue to tick, because if you remember, before Moorhead was brought in from Fordham, like,
thing was a disaster.
Franklin was like a week or two from being fired.
Totally.
he was like on the hottest possible seat. After that, I mean, the one game that will forever stay with me is when Temple, I think, had a 2-man rush and sacked Christian Hackenberg with six protectors, and they lost to Temple. I looked up that GIF like a couple weeks ago, and it's still amazing. I mean, obviously Ohio State was able to know, like, they can go hire whoever they want. They have Tom Wilson there now. I don't know that Penn State will have the same luxury. Who is their offensive coordinator now?
Your offensive coordinator is Ricky Rain.
Ricky Rain.
Ooh, I could not tell you anything about him. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that the Moorhead departure is not really being talked about enough when people evaluate Penn State this year. They lost two games with him, and that was with Saquon Barkley, who was, you know, one of the top five picks in the NFL draft.
And Deshaun Hamilton and Mike Gesicki and obviously Trace McSorley.
And, yeah, most of this defense. And There's I mean, they're obviously bringing in talent at Penn State, but there's a lot to replace, and I could see them going 9-3 this year. That shouldn't be discounted as a possibility.
No, it's definitely in the cards. I mean, just losing a really dynamic offensive coordinator can really hurt any program. I mean, that should be more obvious than it is. I think the big difference between, you know, before Moorhead got there and now is a talent uptick is really big. They're recruiting at a top 10 level now. Before, they were probably like a top 20, 25 level. So hopefully that will offset it for them. And by hopefully, I mean, I don't care because I don't like Penn State. But
nor should anyone.
Yeah. A 9-3 season, though, like, I feel like that would probably be fairly disappointing for Nittany Lion fans, but I don't know that it should be based on the schedule. Like, they really have a tough one, especially this run in the middle. They host Ohio State. They host Michigan State. At Indiana, I don't think Indiana will beat them, but I could easily see that being like a one-touchdown game because it's packaged right between so many big games. And then they bring in Iowa, which they should handle at home, but then at Michigan versus Wisconsin. Like, that's a brutal run all the way from September 29 to November 10th. And they're just lucky they have most of them at home.
Right. All right. Because we're getting late and because we've been doing this for a while, I'm doing one question about each of the last two teams and then we're done.
Okay.
Will Michigan finish better than third in this division?
No, I think they'll finish third.
Same. Northwestern, will they win more games than Michigan?
No.
See, I actually think yes.
I have to look at the two schedules, but I'm projecting.
That's fair. I don't blame you there. Cool. Well, that was the Big Ten preview. Dan,
should Northwestern with the amount of focus that they deserve.
Honestly, like, I would have talked about Northwestern a lot more. We just kind of ran out of time. This is what happens when you have 14 goddamn teams. anyway, Dan, who do you see win the division? Ohio State conference? Ohio State or Wisconsin?
I'm rooting Wisconsin. I think it'll be Ohio State.
Same here.
And I like Ohio State. I feel like I should dislike more, but they're very fun to watch.
They are. I hate them so much.
It's one of
those
things. But like, they're fun. Want to like Ohio State? They're a lot of fun when they're good.
Agreed. All right, that's the story, and we're sticking to it. We'll see you guys next week. There should be a decent amount of things to talk about coming out of ACC football kickoff and Dino Babers saying things. I'm sure somebody else in college football will say something dumb, even if it's not the same level of Larry Fedora. And we're talking SEC, so that also obviously brings its own collection of entertainment value next week for sure.
This is the podcast that ranks the SEC behind the Pac-12.
Ha! Take that. Anyway, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and we are getting dangerously close to talking about actual Orange football.
Yes, we are.
Go Orange in the future.
Go Orange.